I thank your lordship for dismissing the plea of insanity offered by the gentleman of my defense. It is obvious to anyone that I am not mad, and my reasoning is sound. The Attorney General has told you, and he has told you truly, that till this period my name, my character, were without blemish. Till this melancholy, this deplorable transaction, which no man, I can solemnly assure you, laments more deeply than I do, till this fatal but necessary moment, my life was without reproach. It is the government and the state which reduced me to despair.
Before considering my son's case, I want to pass on some of the results of my contemplations. Namely, that the artist is never satisfied with things as they are. He must either improve or desecrate, put pressure upon reality until it breaks or dwindles, then gaze resolvedly upon the stark patterns of destruction or diminution.
That it was my arm destroyed him, I allow. That he perished by my hand, I admit. But to constitute a felony, there must be malice aforethought. That has not been proved in my intentions against the person. Only what he represented as the embodiment of that power which caused my defeat and misery. You must acquit me. It is the only rational result of this tragedy I have produced.
Another revelation I must pass on to those who haven't thought about it. There are no gentlemen in heaven or hell, and as my son will confirm, nothing in life is rational. With an expression of the strangest pride, the executioner's boy now and then uncovers my son's face for the curious as the cart grinds from the gallows up the Old Bailey, Newgate Street, St. Martin's Le Grand, Little Britain, to the company of surgeons at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in Duke Street, where Sir William Blizzard will dissect my boy's body, and, to the amazement and consternation of the audience, find his heart still beating. But it is not my son's life that is in there. It is me. The blood on Blizzard's table is mine.
My blessed wife, I assure you, my love, my sincerest endeavors have ever been directed to your welfare. As we shall not meet any more in this world, I sincerely hope we shall do so in the world to come.
The blood is mine.
My blessings to the boys. With the purest of intentions, it has always been my misfortune to be thwarted, misrepresented, and ill-used in life. But, however, we feel a happy prospect of compensation in a speedy translation to life eternal. Yours, ever affectionate,
John Bellingham. He thought it was the last letter, but at 11 o'clock at night he wrote again, not mentioning speculations on the infinite. The final full sentence he inscribed in the English language, philosophy's fittest framework, was: the public sympathize much for me, but I have been called upon to play an anxious card in life. So the gambler has the last word. On the morning of the day when my son took action against his sea of troubles and by opposing ended them, he was greatly concerned with detail. How much a washerwoman charged him for laundering his dressing gown. A shilling. If he had known how extortionate she was going to be, he'd have done it himself. And the other major issue in his life was what he had or had not put in his pockets.
With £5,000, I could pay off all my debts, buy the house in Hope Street, fully establish the business. That's all I asked. They said no. Never. I worked it out, showed them figures. Never. Why bring the opera glass now? What will there be to look at? It's only an extra burden, another bulge. I'm not going to watch him. I'm not going to follow him. I'm going to wait for him. But I might need it. I might. Something unseen.
There must be a reason for a man who is so punctilious, so particular, so neat, to fill his pockets with what he doesn't need for his purposes. If he looks through the glass one way, the world is bigger. If he looks through the other, it's smaller. My son has put choice in his pocket. The big end he'll strike, the little shrivel. 4 p.m., May the 11th, 1812. As the clocks strike everywhere, King George III is incurably mad. The French Grande Armée is massing on the Russian border, and the House of Commons is girding up its loins to debate the decline of trade it has imposed upon the nation. This measure is central to the war against Napoleon. Everyone must stop trading with France, the France that is smeared all over Europe. Those who enter into commerce with the Corsican must suffer, their ships be impounded, sailors arrested. What a lot to talk about. But only 10% of members of Parliament have turned up. The absentees obviously know something, or the interests behind them have forbidden their attendance. They will regret not being there today. There will be some excitement, a reshuffle of a sort. Spencer Percival, son of the Earl of Egmont, brilliant barrister and all that, totally incorruptible Tory, oh, Harrow and Cambridge, etc., the present Prime Minister and leader of the War Cabinet, is coming to the chamber to face the music. How can the nation prosper when it is cutting its own throat? The people are living hard lives, paying higher and higher prices merely to subsist. Must we destroy our trade in order to destroy Napoleon, is the question. And the answer Mr. Percival proposes to give is yes. Leicester Square. My son John, timber merchant, shipper, etc., presently of Liverpool and the Irish trade, says goodbye to his landlady and her child, who have accompanied him to an art gallery in St. James to see some of my work. My posthumous opinion of all the pieces is low, but I espy the connections his mind is making. After his farewell, John strides away, looking at his watch, but soon has to slow down. He leans forward as he walks, a frown on his long, thin, serious face. His landlady, who has been observing his departure with a mixture of fondness and concern, has been wondering about this new way of walking of his since they set out from home this morning.
Shouldn't have had the pockets made so low down. 9 inches high would have been right. Each step, bang, bang in the thighs. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end I'm quite bruised thereabouts. Not enough thought, John. Bad planning. Ought to have made a test walk after I'd had the coat altered and tried things out. It mustn't make me late. A slower but longer swing of the leg? Even longer? Oh, no, then they get between my knees. The short, quick step still best. I'd catch a cab if one would stop, but they won't at this time of day. Not such a good notion, arriving in a cab and having to extricate myself. No accidents, please. Flexible timetable, while to spare in case he arrives early. But he's never early. He likes to keep people waiting a good long time. He's always late for everything. Next time we meet, she'll know what's been on my mind. I won't have to hide anything from her. I know I've bored her with the whole business these last few months, all the paperwork, the letters and petitions, the sweats and indignations. It seems unfair to have kept this from her. She'd want to know what's so important to me and why. But I made her no promises. No promises. When she finds out, she'll remember that, I hope. I couldn't afford any pledges. But I have a feeling Rachel will be steadfast without compulsion when she hears what I've done. Her knowledge of me, my knowledge of him. When I tried to tell my wife what he stood for, her ignorance amazed me. How he brooded over my predicament with his championing of the French war, severest taxation. Oh, what do I care about all that? She doesn't listen like Rachel does. Don't talk about it, she says. I don't want to hear. Never mention Russia again. Which means do not breathe, do not think, do not suffer, do not remember 5 years in hell for no fault of my own. Going to see my father's pictures with her and Tommy was a bad idea. I thought it would strengthen my resolve, but I discovered that needs no strengthening. All looking at those miniatures did was weaken my memory of him. Portrait of a lady, portrait of a gentleman. Very, very small. Very, very near. Very, very organized. Very, very perfect. What made him want to paint on that kind of scale? What made him want to paint them? Who are they? Their mouths could be anyone's mouths. Their expressions cold and empty. When you went to your fine new home in such state, you should have had your miniatures, one in each hand, to show the man at the asylum gate. Your tickets of admission. Portrait of a lady. Portrait of a gentleman. These are the people who brought me here.
Don't talk about it. Don't want to hear. Я не понимаю. Shut up, shut up. Don't bother me with it. Drink your soup. Clean up your own shit, Protestant.
At this rate, I'll be in the lobby by 4:15, which is fine. With the traffic as it is down St. Martin's Lane, I'm better off walking anyway. Would have been a better idea to strap the pistols to my legs, perhaps, or round my middle and loosen them up when I got there. Too late to think about that now. They'll have to bump along as I go. I'll stop at St. Martin's in the fields for another prayer. Give my thighs a rest. Sit quietly. Have to, even with no time. There is no other way to bring my case before a court. They have denied me, mocked me, expelled me, shooed me away, barred me from further appeal. Like my wife. Don't mention it. It's quiet. Get rid of that base thought, that memory before entering here. Must be nothing but a crank. Go thy ways. From the Prince Regent downwards, through every department and ministry of government, all I get in answer to my petitions, go thy ways. Then, in such annoyance, Mr. Bellingham, we've had enough of this. Don't talk about it. Don't want to hear. You're never going to get any compensation out of us. You are forbidden to carry on with this complaint. If this is not acceptable to you, do your worst. They are the Luciferian tempters. What worst can they have imagined? What worst is available to a citizen who's been denied justice? I was innocent. I suffered the destruction of my liberty and my livelihood because the government refused to help me. What else should I do but that worst? They put me in mind of it. It's part of the way they think, not I. Part of their grievance procedure against the citizen. If he exhausts the patience of the state, kill him. If the state exhausts the patience of the man, kill the state. Only one real form, you can find it. The Prime Minister. The Crime Minister. Not the man. That part of him dies in another time by another hand which has more to do with fate than with myself. Stay firm. The reason holds. The jury will understand. Now I can talk to my God.
My son's faith in the jury system is worrying. It reveals a flaw in his mental processes. Why should 12 absurd patriots have a good view on anything? His trust in them is something he never inherited from me.
Every juryman will know how this government has disemboweled business in the prosecution of this war, and how, perversely, it is the merchants who are blamed for its failures. Cabinet after cabinet throw up their hands and resign, go home to their estates and get drunk for 10 years, blaming the scorned mercantile class for greed, lack of support, refusal to be taxed. Every juror will have felt the contempt our rulers have for those who live by honest trade. And they will know, to a man, the difficulties of commerce abroad, dealing with petty officials and entrepreneurs in foreign lands whose corruption surpasses anything to be encountered here, at home. This John Bellingham is one of us, they will think. We know what he's been through. The brunt of their lordship's disdain and ignorance of present conditions in the life of British businessmen abroad is known to them. The prisoner is innocent as charged. The guilt for the crime falls upon the man who perished. He brought it on himself. A variation on the theme of suicide. If he had listened and paid the 5,000... And as we have heard from Mr. Bellingham, no stone was left unturned to warn him of the consequences of refusal.
Fatherhood is a mystery, drawing its doubts, devilments, and conundrums from the creation itself. I never knew what to do with it. Watching a mother cat with her blind kittens, one grasps immediately the way maternalism works. But the male who prowls in the shrubbery outside the window, a strange half-smile, half-frown on his face, he's wondering what he's done, what he's given, how much of himself has been reduced by the exercise of instinct. Are his children mirrors or masks for his deficiencies? Nowhere in the relationship between father and son do I perceive reason, sense, or judgment.
The jury will understand. The apostles will understand.
Here I am again, Lord. Haven't got much time. Haunting you these days. No one else to talk to about this. No one at all. This is the last church before Westminster. Once there, I'm beyond prayer of this kind. To shoot into the heart stops it for only an instant, and you will be there, holding time in your hand until the power emerges again, fresh, purified, more open, ready to listen. In that instant of destruction, as my bullet enters his heart, as it must, I ask, all I ever seem to do is ask for forgiveness, because a boy like my boy, he was a young boy as I was, and a man and a father and a husband, is attached to my action, which is not against him who is part of you, but his power, which is impervious. Death. Worldliness.
The Psalm of David. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischiefs like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Selah.
Oh, there are too many paintings in here. Let's rush. Oh! The guns.
Have you hurt yourself, old chap?
I'm all right. Really, I am. They've gone off.
You brought me low to make your sign. I will not hurt thee. They shall not hurt thee.
Even in thy stumbling, you continue to watch over my innocence, Lord.
Whitehall. Government offices, offices, offices. To the left, banqueting house. On a timber scaffold at a first-floor window, King Charles I was decapitated for not listening. Son John passes beneath the spot on his way to Westminster. When his own time comes, he behaves with similar fortitude and dignity to that of the king. Asked if he's any final thing to say to the enormous throng, the hordes of special constables and 5,000 troops standing by to stop a revolution, John needs no further encouragement and starts up on his old theme of Russia, prison, his losses, and has to be silenced because he is boring his audience. Having shut him up, the presiding minister of religion is kind enough to ask John how he feels. He looks around him, sees the slogans, Bellingham forever, rescue Bellingham, etc., painted on the walls, and cannot think of anything appropriate. This gigantic jury gathered round him would never bring in a verdict to deny themselves the sport of his death. Their verdict is, get on with it. As the hangman goes below to knock away the only real support John has left, my son thinks to himself, they love me, but they'll let me go. But I'm getting ahead of him. Let's go back to his walking, the bumping of those hard steel pistols on his thighs.
My mouth is dry. Glass of beer won't take that long. I'm sweating in this coat. Smell to high heaven.
Half a bitter, if you please. Yes, warmish, I'd say. Definitely warmish.
He stands at the counter, keeping it at arm's length in case he knocks the pistols.
With all the bumping during the walk, the powder and ball might have become loosened. I'll have to check them.
He drains his glass and goes to the back of the tavern. Once in the foul-smelling urinal, he quickly checks both pistols, keeping an eye open in case someone comes. He has done his job well with the loading of them that morning. Everything is firm and in place. He puts the pistols away, pulls back his heavy coat, and relieves himself. At that moment, he is not 100 yards from an office where he was once listened to by a tedium-stricken, fidgeting, uncivil servant.
You have all the papers, sir, but I'll go over it again. No one disputes the facts. A powerful competitor in the timber trade in Archangel arranged for my imprisonment on a false charge of debt. His influence was great with the Governor-General, but he could not have me found guilty. That was beyond him. All the charges were dropped, and I was discharged from prison. I went to St. Petersburg, where I was immediately rearrested by the influence of the same man. You ask for a reason for this vindictiveness. From hearsay, it appears he believes I informed against him, in a case of insurance whereby he arranged for the sinking of his own ship. No, I did not, though the matter was much talked about amongst the merchants of Archangel. While in prison in St. Petersburg, I approached our ambassador at the court of Tsar Alexander for help as a distressed British citizen wrongfully detained and innocent of all charges made against me. Lord Gower could have obtained my release within a day, but chose not to because he knew Napoleon was encouraging the Tsar to treat all British merchants savagely, and my case became a casualty of the ambassador's acquiescent timidity. We are talking about 5 years of my life. Someone must pay. The Russians certainly won't, not with Napoleon now on their doorstep over this same issue of closing Russia to British trade. This government must compensate me. Sir, I was released without charge. What does that say to you? One word from the ambassador in the right place and the influence of my enemy would have been overcome. On behalf of this government, he chose to stay silent. Now that I'm at liberty and in a free country, I must have my wrongs rectified and my fortunes repaired by those elected to protect my rights. You, sir, you If the state does not exist for the citizen, what right does it have to exist at all? For the king's peace?
What peace did I have from abuse and insult and starvation and vermin and sickness and despair all that time, separated from my wife and child? I am owed, sir, owed for all that suffering. It was the war. If this government had not prosecuted the French war and ruined relations with Napoleon and Tsar Alexander, none of this would have happened. Can you understand? I did nothing. I didn't start the war. I was trapped by circumstances, none of my own making. Let me go, you ruffians. I can walk. I can walk.
Such a simple matter. I gave the Prime Minister the opportunity to sort it out when he was President of the Board of Trade. Office after office, passed on, back to the same person, try a new route, always ending up at a blank wall. I know they used to see me coming and leave. The months I've spent in waiting rooms to see ministers, all for nothing. An extension of prison for me. And it all goes on the bill. How can a man conduct his business with this round his neck? It must be settled. It must be brought into the open. Once it is, people will realize why I had to act. Whatever wrong I do is far outweighed by the righteousness of my cause. And it is everyone's cause. Our agreement to be governed at all depends upon the guarantee of justice. Without that, why should we submit? If all we receive is aloofness and indifference, our concurrence melts away. I, in my patience, have hung on to my concurrence. This is the final act of my patience. It's not anger. It's not anarchy. It's my voice making itself heard. From which direction will he come? Downing Street? Will I see him as he passes? No.
No.
He'll be late. And he'll walk on such a fine day. Mr. Spencer Percival likes to walk. He walks with a smile as though he's enjoying it. He swings his cane and tosses his head. He waves to passers-by who hail him.
Good luck to you, sir. We'll show Boney, eh?
I've heard them. Once or twice, I think he's even included me in his salute. An Englishman with other Englishmen idolizing him in the street. But his letter to me telling me no, no, no was the opposite of hail fellow well met. But a man who likes to walk, to feel his limbs, shooting him down?
Yeah, how long has he ever spent in chains?
If there was time, I'd explain before I pulled the trigger. I'd show him copies of the correspondence. My letter to the police magistrates at the public office Bow Street, notifying them that as I had not been given justice, I'd manage it myself. I told my own MP to his face I would force the matter into a court. Informed General Gascoigne in his own house, the time had come to act. I even went as far, Mr. Percival, as to write to the Secretary of State in the same vein. I look upon it that I am now at liberty to take such measures as I think proper. Do your worst, came the reply, Mr. Percival. And I heard them laughing as I closed the door. From that time, we have taken this walk together along Whitehall, arm in arm. The Commons. Chapel of the Old Kings, stumpy spired. How many times have I walked towards you, hoping for help? I did believe. Don't have to go there. Climb up those high steps. I can stroll past and continue along the river and not change history. For if I do it, I will achieve that. All I want to change is a tiny fraction of it, which contains my ruinous frustration, the distillation of my shame and loss. Innocence and grief are the altars of history, and they need their sacrifices. I hate the sound of my own voice. It has ground out my trouble like a mill. Even in its truth, I hate it. There's no music there, no succor, no beauty like the lady and the gentleman in their small, sweet smiles. From here, I want my mind to be quiet, to stop revolving and revolving.
I will not debate the matter anymore. £5,000 is all I asked, a mere £5,000.
None of this need happen. I wasn't worth £5,000 to anyone, but now I am. Not to have this happen would be worth £5,000 to them. They'd pay it if they knew. £1,000 for every year of my suffering in the filthiest prisons in the world. £5,000? The Prince Regent bets that on a fist fight.
You need say no more, Mrs. Bellingham. I have my instructions, it seems. Silence on the subject is what you desire, and you shall have it. More than any other person in the world, you know the extent of my suffering and loss. Indeed, you have borne the brunt of it with me. But now you wish to forget. If only I could feel the same way. If only I could be released from the wound, the hurt and the damage. Oh, I'd be grateful, madam. I would. I swear to you, I would. But it will not leave me alone. It is my grim companion in every waking hour, this rankling, nagging, you call it obsession, which is a nice word with a very wide meaning. Where does injustice fit into obsession? What does a man have to do in this life? Live as if the disagreeable part never took place? Pretend to be satisfied with his deserts when they've never been granted him? Bend the knee? I have pleaded and cajoled for my compensation and got nowhere. What do you suggest I do now? Ah, yes. Shut my mouth. Shut down my mind. Shut out reality and be bland. All is well. There's always the future.
Silence you will have. As much as you like. When I leave Liverpool for London on Wednesday, fill the house with people who do not know or remember me. Talk about life with nice people who do not know me. Don't refer to my existence. Get the children to forget their father, in case all they remember is his pain. No, no, this is not extreme. It's what you desire.
Why do you think a man of business goes to London?
Ah, we agreed we wouldn't mention that subject. Have I no other life? Don't I have to find sustenance for us?
Other ships still sail, other cargoes are carried.
I have never given up, have I? Bowed my head under the weight of the unmentionable. I will stay with Mrs. Rachel Robarts, where I've stayed comfortably before, close to the city. I will write regularly. No, you must not, cannot ask that question. We have agreed never to have it raised between us again. If I tell you I am going to London on business, by your own desires, you are prevented from questioning me further. Offices I will go to.
Notes and letters will be conveyed. Meetings will happen. There will be an end result, I hope. You are no longer entitled to know the details of what I will be doing. Good night.
Seventeen, 18, 19, 20. Every time I count the steps up to the Commons, the total is different. Today cannot help but be the right amount. 28.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
30.
Did I miss one? I did. I must go back. Was it 27? I can't go back to the bottom and start again. That would look foolish. Oh, I'd like to have been certain.
I won't count any more. Thank God the walking is over and I can find somewhere to sit in the lobby. My thighs are so sore.
Has the Prime Minister arrived yet for the Orders in Council debate?
Thank you. He's late. That's reassuring. He's running to form. He'll be where I want him. If he'd broken with his tradition of discourtesy and been on time, or even early, it would perhaps have saved his life. But he is what he is, and that is why he will be blotted out.
How are you, sir?
I think it will stay fine. I do. Good afternoon, sir.
Yes, still at my post.
I know every face, fellow petitioners, high, middle, and low, all waiting for a glimpse, a nod, even a smile, perhaps. They all have things in their pockets for Mr. Percival which they'd like him to look at in passing when he has time, if he would be so good. How many times have I stood here hoping to catch his eye, my papers at the ready? But he has never chosen to favour me with a glance as he makes his entrance. The petitioners will applaud him, fawningly. They always do, and always have, going back to the first blue-daubed chief coming into the tribal cave. That is our original sin. Obedience. The other god in the garden, the one who sold the fruit, the one who ran the market. The Prime Minister sets out to walk the quarter mile from 10 Downing Street to the House of Commons. His step is brisk, his manner airy. He is looking forward to disappointing his enemies and inspiring his friends. In his mind, he has a list of telling points to make upon the subject under debate. He smiles as, ahead of the occasion, he hears in his head the growl of the opposition and the baying of his supporters at his back. This is where he shines, steady, poised, eloquent, lucid, and unshakable. I'll be given plenty of advance warning of his arrival. There are scouts out on the steps, scanning the approach. A tremor will run through this band of brothers in need. They'll shiver with anticipations and hopes, set their shoulders more abjectly, adjust their smiles.
Yes, sir, I'm very well indeed. A wonderful day out there, so clear and warm.
They speak to me in case I'm someone. I am someone. I have influence. I have powerful friends in my pocket. It's worth tipping your hat to me, sir.
Oh, the same, the same. And I've noticed you, sir, and your exemplary good nature day after day. So very composed and careful. If I could help you, I would. Oh, my advice would be, stay around until he comes. Try again. Try and try again. Our entire system of government is based upon the patience of the people.
He's so bored and distracted by his daily vigils, he's forgotten how often he's attempted to solicit my help, a stranger who just happens to be here. I know his suffering. He's been here so long, life has become meaningless. But he is too weak to move himself into the sphere of action. Within the hour, I will give him his life back. He may not recognize it as history turns top to bottom. They've sighted him.
No, sir, I'll stay inside. I had a good walk here myself earlier and am enjoying the cool.
No one is more excited than I, Mr. Percival, but I only want to see you at the moment it is performed.
The Prime Minister is at the bottom of the steps. He knows exactly how many there are. Every time he counts them, the number remains the same. That's how he likes things to be. But count them he does, by habit and as a discipline of the mind and memory as he prepares to ignore the petitioners and the arguments of his opponents. He is as right as the number of steps is right. There is no other way to govern this land. With a true gentleman's unerring confidence, he places his foot on the first step of the flight to his scaffold, while his executioner pauses in contemplation of his own.
They will understand. I cannot help but be acquitted. No jury of Englishmen in their right minds can deny the justice of my case. I put myself in the hand of God, whose judgment I do not fear. Draw him out carefully. Don't snag the lining. Hold. Hold. and not his face. Avoid his eyes. They're blue. You have to look at him. He's with others now, surrounded as he comes through the door. Petitions thrust into his face, hands outstretched, pleading. Face him. Recognize him. Be sure. Blue eyes, wide blue eyes. He's smiling. As he swats the petitions aside, he's smiling. He has to. I have to.
There's no need to hurt me. You'll break my arm. Don't push me. I submit myself to justice. Yes, Mr. Percival is dead and all his children orphans. I am sorry for it. I am the most unfortunate man. I wish I were in Mr. Percival's place. My name is John Bellingham. It is a private injury. I know what I have done. It was a denial of justice on the part of the government.
A murder committed on the doorstep of the highest court of the land causes a very special kind of confusion. The feeling is, should it be dealt with at once? All the judges are here, the power is here. But protocol has to be consulted and the matter debated as the shock waves roll round the ancient palace of the kings. In Parliament Square, a jubilant mob gathers, intoxicated with the news the Prime Minister has been killed. When an attempt is made to take my son to Newgate Prison in a coach, the mob attack it in order to set him free. The horse guards are quickly called out to escort the hero to his new home. At the gate, he shows the keeper my two miniatures. Portrait of a lady, portrait of a gentleman. Go through, the fellow says. I looked after your dad somewhere. Somewhere?
In Assassins, a mere £5,000 by David Pownall, John Bellingham was played by David Horovitch. The director was Owen O'Callaghan.